Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true?
They don't think Christianity's true.
They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
What is the most important skill you need to learn if you want your life to be a success? Think about that for a minute. What is the most important skill you need to learn if you want your life to be a success? What do you got? What are you thinking? Let me modify the question a little bit, because it's probably too vague for you to think about what I'm thinking about, and it might remain too vague when I modify it, but let me try. What is the most important skill you need to learn if you want your life to be a success into eternity? What is the most important skill you need to learn if you want your life to be a success into eternity? I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the answer to that question is the skill you need to learn to make your life be a success into eternity is to properly interpret the Bible. That's the skill you need to have if you want your life to be a success into eternity. And last week, we talked about how not to interpret the Bible. In fact, the title of that particular podcast, that particular radio program here on the American Family Radio Network, was "There Are No Verses in the Bible." In fact, last week, you may remember, I asked a question. I said, if you're in a room with a friend and he is reading from a newspaper and he just reads you this one quote. Here's the quote. He says, "After a strike, your entire team will celebrate." And I asked you last week, what does that sentence mean? Well, you don't know what it means. Why? Because you could be about bowling. It could be about baseball, fishing, volleyball. It could be an oil or gold strike. It could be a diamond strike. It could be a union strike. It could be a military strike. It could be a horoscope, for all you know. You don't know. Why? Because you don't have the context. You would say, hey, where in that paper is that from? What section is it in? What's the name of the story? Who's speaking here? What's the story about? You have to have some basic interpretation skills in order to know what that sentence means. You need the context. And so what I'd like to talk about today is some ways that you can properly interpret the Bible, because it's important, ladies and gentlemen. It's important to interpret the Bible. And last time we said, well, you couldn't be able to figure out what "after a strike, your entire team will celebrate" means. You wouldn't be able to figure out what that, let's call it a verse, means unless you knew what the overall context. And so I asked you the question, how would you know what this sentence means? "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." How would you know what that means unless you knew the context? You wouldn't. I mean, you might know what the words mean, but you wouldn't know whether or not it applies to you or not. I mean, who's the you in there? The plans I have for you, is that everybody? Or is that a specific group of people who lived 2,500 years ago in an ancient land called Babylon? Yeah, it's the latter. It's not you today. And we went through this last time. We went through how we do with the Bible what we would never do with a newspaper. We would never just take a sentence out of the newspaper and think we know what it meant without knowing what the proper context is. And so some of the things we talked about last time, and we'll just review, and then we'll get into how to properly interpret the Bible. Some of the things oh, by the way, if you're just tuning in, this is Frank Turek. You're listening to Cross Examine with Frank Turek on the American Family Radio Network. Ways not to interpret the Bible are reading one verse and ignoring the context. Always pointing the compass to yourself. What's the compass? That you think everything in life points to you. Your life's true north. No, sometimes, many times, most of the time, the compass doesn't point to you. And many times, when you're reading the Bible, it's not about you. It's about somebody else. It helps you understand what God is about and how he deals with people, but it's not directly applicable to you in the sense you think it is. Jeremiah 29:11 is not directly applicable to you as many people think it is. So, those are a couple of ways we misinterpret the Bible. We just take a verse out of context and we don't even know what it means. We also said that assuming God approves everything recorded in the Bible is a improper way to interpret it. You know, when people say there's polygamy in the Old Testament. Yeah, okay, right? That doesn't mean God approved it. God disapproved of polygamy. But it recorded what happened. It was a description of what happened, not a prescription of how things ought to happen. And you always have to figure out when you're reading the Bible, is this a description or a prescription? We also said that assuming God approves of behaviors that Jesus didn't specifically prohibit is an error in interpreting the Bible. You know, Jesus never said anything about that. And therefore, you know, it must be okay. And the Babylon Bee, a brilliant Christian satire site, has a headline. It says this, and we mentioned this last week. Jesus never said anything about felony home invasion either. But that doesn't mean he was for it. You know? Yes, he talked about thou shalt not steal. But that doesn't mean he specifically mentioned felony home invasion or specifically approved of felony home invasion. He talked about the category. He didn't talk about the specifics. And some people will say, well, he didn't talk about homosexuality. Yeah, he didn't talk about that specifically, personally, but he did talk about the category, sexual immorality, which included homosexuality and every other sexual activity outside of the marriage of a man and a woman. You see, the black letters are just as inspired as the red letters, by the way. Just because Jesus didn't say anything about it as recorded in the red letter edition of your Bible doesn't mean that the Bible approves of what Jesus didn't specifically prohibit. Because Jesus, as you know, if Christianity is true, is a part of the eternal Trinity here. He's the second person in the eternal Trinity, and the entire Bible was inspired by God. So just because Jesus didn't say it when he was on earth, specifically, doesn't mean he approved it, although he did say it when he talked about sexual immorality. Also, we talked about another way that we misinterpret the Bible, moralizing historical texts, like taking Jesus calmed the storm, which is a historical text about Jesus literally calming a storm on the Sea of Galilee. And he did that. It showed that he has power over nature, which is what the Messiah would have power over nature, power over sickness, power over death. Why? Because nature, sickness, and death hurt us. And in order to restore the creation to its pristine state, the Messiah would have power over nature, sickness, and death. And Jesus does. But many people will take the event, Jesus calmed the storm, and they'll moralize it to say, well, Jesus can calm the storms of your life. Well, that may be true. He might be able to do that, but don't use that passage as, or don't interpret that passage to teach that, because it doesn't. Jesus is calming the storm. He's calming a real storm. Not a metaphor in your life, not a storm in your life. Also, we said that we don't want to literalize figurative text. That's another problem. Like, we don't want to say the Bible's in error when it talks about sunrise and sunset. Why? Because we talk about sunrise and sunset. We don't say, look at the beautiful earth rotation, honey. We use the same observational language the Bible does because it's written from an observational perspective. So we don't literalize figurative text. When we see that it says Jesus is the door, we don't think he has hinges and a doorknob. We understand that that's not a literal text. It's a metaphorical text. It's showing us that Jesus is the way to salvation. It doesn't mean that literally he's a door. So with those six things or six ways of misinterpreting the Bible, we're now going to transition after the break to how to interpret the Bible. Remember, here's how not to interpret it. Don't read one verse and ignore the context. Don't always point the compass to yourself. Don't assume God approves of everything recorded in the Bible. Don't assume God approves of behaviors that Jesus didn't specifically prohibit. Don't moralize historical texts, and don't literalize figurative texts. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how is the proper way, or what is the proper way to interpret the Bible, the most important skill you need to have to have a successful life. And we're going to talk about that right after the break. My name is Frank Turek. You're listening to Cross Examined with Frank Turek and the American Family Radio Network. We're back in 2 minutes. Don't go away. What's the most important skill you need to learn if you want your life to be a success into eternity? The answer to that question, in my opinion, is you need to know how to interpret the Bible. Because if you don't interpret the Bible properly, you might not even get to the right eternity you want. And you might not live your life here properly. And so you need to learn how to interpret the Bible. Now, before we get into how to do that, let me mention that we have some events coming up that I want you to know about. Events where I'll be this weekend, in fact, tomorrow, right now as we speak, we're at Catalina Foothills Church in Tucson, Arizona. In fact, we're there from 9 to 1 Pacific time. So if you're anywhere near Catalina Foothills Church, we're doing our Fearless Faith Seminar today, Saturday. It's myself, the great J. Warner Wallace, cold case homicide detective, and the equally great Dr. Mike Adams from UNC Wilmington, University of North Carolina at Wilmington. We're doing our Fearless Faith program at Catalina Foothills Church in Tucson. And tomorrow, Sunday, I'll be doing the morning services there. You can get all this information off our website, crossexamine.org. Then next weekend, I will be in Barrington, Illinois, right near Chicago, for a worldview conference at Village Church in Barrington, Illinois, and then speaking at the Sunday services again. Then a couple of days after that, the 22nd, of February, let me see what, that's actually a Wednesday, I'll be at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, doing I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Limited seating, only about 200. The auditorium is the biggest one we could get there, so if you want to go to that, you better get there early. It starts at 8 p.m. on the 22nd. We will stream that live. That's our intention anyway, so you can tune in on Facebook Live at our Cross Examined Facebook page. You need to like our Facebook page if you want to see the feed, and go there at 8 p.m. Eastern on the 22nd. And then what's happening after that? The Tactical Evangelism Seminar in Trinity, North Carolina on the 25th of February. That's up between Charlotte and Raleigh. I'll be there with my friend, the great Dr. Richard Howe. And also there'll be some other speakers there as well in Trinity, North Carolina. So you'll want to check that out. And then I'll be going to Canada after that, up in Vancouver. All this information is up on our website, crossexamined.org. So check it all out and hope to see you out there. Now let's get back to our topic of the day. Our topic of the day is how to interpret the Bible. And let me just come right out and say, it is never, what does this verse mean to you? That's not the right way to interpret the Bible. If you're in a Bible study right now and somebody turns to you and goes, hey, Ed, or hey, Sarah, what does this verse mean to you? That's not the right question to ask. I mean, the right question is, what does it mean according to Paul or Jesus or Luke or whoever wrote it down? Jesus didn't write it down, but Luke did. You get the idea. What did it mean when Jesus said it? Because the meaning can't be what you want it to be. It's what God intended it to be, as expressed in the text. In fact, I think there's three things you're trying to do when you're interpreting the Bible. First thing, you're trying to figure out, what are you trying to discover? The second thing is, why are you trying to discover it? And then thirdly is, how are you going to discover it? And then finally, how do you apply it, obviously? All right, what are you trying to discover? What are you trying to discover when you're interpreting the Bible? Here's what you're trying to discover. You're trying to discover the meaning God intended as expressed in the text, not your own meaning imposed on the text. I mean, after all, you want God's word, not your own, right? I mean, if you're trying to read the text, if you're trying to read the Bible, you're trying to figure out what God means, not what you want it to mean. In fact, there are some words you need to understand in the interpretation of the Bible. One is called hermeneutics. That's actually what you're doing when you're interpreting the Bible. It's called hermeneutics, and it actually comes from the Greek mythological deity called Hermes, who is apparently the messenger of the gods. And so when you're doing hermeneutics, you're trying to discover a message from God. That's where the word comes from, or the term comes from, hermeneutics. And there are two ways of doing hermeneutics, a right way and a bad way. The right way is called exegesis. That's when you're trying to get the meaning out of the text. The wrong way is eisegesis. That's when you're trying to read your own meaning into the text. So we want to exegete. We want to get what God's word is out of the text. That's what we're trying to do. So you're trying to discover the meaning God intended. Secondly, and this probably goes without saying, now I've been using the word enough, we discover the meaning, we don't determine it. We discover what the text means, we don't determine what the text means. I remember we had a debate here at the Southern Evangelical Seminary about 7-8 years ago. It was between Bart Ehrman, who, as you know, is a skeptic, and Mike Lacona, who is a Christian scholar, and they were having a debate over the historical reliability of the documents. And Ehrman made this claim during the debate. He said that when you read a text, you're changing it. Now, this is a view technically known as deconstructionism. In fact, I think he was trying to advance the idea that when you read a text, you are changing the text in the sense that the reader determines the meaning. You know, the meaning is not in the text. When you read it, you're determining the meaning. And so our professor over there, Tom Howe, great guy, wrote a number of books with Dr. Norman Geisler. One of them is a very important book you need to have in your library. It's called The Big Book of Bible Difficulties. Also, it used to be called When Critics Ask, but he and Dr. Geisler went through about 800 different passages in the Bible that critics have said either are contradictory or there's a problem there, and they give a rational response to those critical claims. It used to be called When Critics Ask. Now it's called The Big Book of Bible Difficulties. Anyway, Tom is very astute. So during the Q&A, he asked Ehrman this question. He said, Dr. Ehrman, when I'm reading your book, am I changing the text? In other words, am I getting my meaning, or am I putting my meaning into your book in a sense? And Ehrman said, well, I think that's the problem with all human communication. You know, I could send you an email that will give you more information on that. It was, you know, Ehrman didn't really want to deal with the objection because he knew it was a self-defeating objection. And Tom said, well, if you send me an email, when I read that email, am I going to change that too? Am I going to somehow put my own meaning into your email? You see, the problem with this view called deconstructionism, that the reader determines the meaning, when authors say that, they don't want you to do that with their books. Ehrman doesn't want you, when you read his book, to put your meaning into his words. He wants you to understand what his meaning is. So it's a completely self-defeating proposition, deconstructionism. And so what I'm trying to say here in a roundabout way is when you're reading a text, you're trying to discover what the meaning is. You don't determine what the meaning is. You're trying to discover what the text means, what the author intended, and you have to use proper interpretation techniques to do that, which we'll get to here in a couple of minutes. And let me put it this way. A biblical passage can't mean now what it didn't mean then. In other words, the Bible is God's unchangeable word for all generations. So there's not a private meaning that you have for the Bible. There may be a private application, but not a private meaning. A particular text may apply to you differently than it applies to me because you have a different situation going on in your life right now than my life. Maybe the text for me, there's no direct application right now. But you're going through a particular situation where there is a direct application for your life right now. The application may be different, but the meaning isn't different. Okay? And the application can never be divorced from the meaning. So a biblical passage can't mean now what it didn't mean when it was written down. The Babylon Bee has a headline. Here's what it says. It shows a woman looking at her iPhone. It says, progressive Christian refreshes Bible app to see if God has updated his stance on homosexuality. The story goes on to say, from her local Starbucks Monday morning, progressive Christian blogger Rachel Brooks reportedly refreshed her Bible app a number of times, hoping to find that God had updated his antiquated stance on homosexuality, according to several eyewitnesses. Look, God's views on moral issues are not going to change. You say, well, wait a minute. Some of God's commands change. Like for example, he commanded in the Old Testament that we don't eat, you know, of certain foods like shrimp and those kind of things, but we can do it in the New Testament. He changed those things. Yes, but those things dealt with the ceremonial law, not the moral law. In the Old Testament, God was trying to keep Israel separate, holy from other nations. And he had the moral law to do that, but also the ceremonial law and these dietary laws. In the New Testament, he also wants us to be separate, but he changed the command. The value behind the command hasn't changed, but the command has changed for these ceremonial or dietary laws. Now you can eat anything you want, but you're still to be separate in the sense you're still to be holy. So be holy hasn't changed. How you're holy has changed. Just like, you know, we change these things with our children. For example, when the children are small, we say, stay out of the street. What's the value behind the command? The value behind the command is children are valuable, life is valuable, it's dangerous in the street, stay out of the street, right? But when they get older, we say, get out on the street and get a job. So the value is still the same. We love our kids. But the command has changed. Why? Because now they're old enough to go out into the world, and they need to go out into the world, and they need to go out and make a living. In order to do that, they have to get out on the street. So the value is the same. Love your child. The command has changed from don't go in the street to do go in the street, because now they are older and they can go in the street and ought to go in the street in order to get a job and make a living. All right? So, God is not going to change the value. He may change the command, but not the value. Now, the value, of course, behind sexual relationships is the fact that God has designed the world in such a way that these things aren't going to change. Sexuality is tied up in our design. And so, the sexual laws are there to protect us. But the dietary laws had another purpose. So, again, we want to make sure that we are discovering the meaning, not determining the meaning. And when we come back, I'm going to give you an easy acronym that will help you do that. So don't go away. You're listening to Cross Examine with Frank Turek and the American Family Radio Network. Our website, crossexamined.org. That's crossexamined with a D on the end of it, .org. We're back in 2 minutes. Don't go away. You're back listening to Cross Examine with Frank Turek and the American Family Radio Network. What is the most important skill you need to learn if you want your life to be a success into eternity? My opinion is you need to learn how to interpret the Bible properly. If you don't interpret the Bible properly, you may not be in the eternity you want to be in at all. And you also may make your life a mess here. So what we're doing today is talking about how to interpret the Bible properly. And we've just mentioned that we want to make sure we're discovering the true meaning of the text, not our own meaning. Let me mention a few other things before we get into an acronym, an easy way for you to do that. And that is, I mentioned last week, there are no verses in the Bible. The Bible is not a series of fortunes. It's not a series of one-liners that you can just apply to your life without any context at all. There's probably only one place in the Bible you can probably do that, and that's Proverbs, because those Proverbs are meant to be one-sentence statements or two-sentence statements that have wisdom in them. But just about every other verse you need context for. So there are no verses in the Bible. And only, let me also say this, that we all get wrapped around the axle trying to interpret certain things in the Bible. But I think the main things are the plain things, and the plain things are the main things. Let me say that again. The main things are the plain things, and the plain things are the main things. If it's not a plain thing, it's probably not a main thing. So don't worry about disputable matters. You know, people will try and figure out who are the sons of God in Genesis 6, who are the four horsemen in Revelation, what's the proper eschatological view, you know, when's the rapture going to occur, if a rapture is going to occur, you know, all these things. They're all interesting, they're all worth investigating, but they're not salvific issues. They're not issues that we're going to divide over. They're not the main things. Because, and they're not even the plain things. If they were the plain things, we wouldn't be arguing over it, right? Okay. Now, some will say, oh, yeah, we argue over some plain things. That's true. I think that's more because people just refuse to follow the text, follow what the text is saying, but that's a whole other issue. I love what Mark Twain said, who's not a Christian, but he said this. He said, it ain't those parts of the Bible that I can't understand that bother me. It's the parts I do understand that bother me, right? So there are plain things out there, and you want to stay on the plain things. Paul talks about this in Romans 14, where he basically says, don't major in the minors. You know, don't divide over disputable matters. Some think drinking wine is a bad thing. Others say it's okay. Some think, say, eating meat to idols is a bad thing. Others say it's okay. And Paul says, don't impose your view on other Christians. Give grace there. Don't worry about those disputable matters. And so with that in mind, we ought to focus on the main things. There is a God. You are not him. You're a sinner. And you need a savior. You've already sinned. So no matter how many good works you do, you can't make up for that. Christ has come. He's lived a perfect life in our place. By trusting in him, you can be saved. I'm reminded of Acts 15, that little first council of the early church fathers, James, Peter, Paul, and they had, in fact, I should go find that text just so I get it right. But in Acts 15, there's a group from the Pharisees who are trying to say, well, should the New Testament believers obey the Old Testament law? And so they brought these things to the church fathers at the time, the apostles. James, Peter, Paul, you know, they're trying to figure out, what should we do? And after they confer on it, here's what they say. In fact, let me read from the Nearly Inspired Version, the NIV. Here's what it says. This is Acts 15 and verse 28. It seemed good to the Holy Spirit and us not to burden you with anything beyond the following requirements. You are to abstain from food sacrificed to idols. According to them, I guess they wanted to stay they didn't want you to eat that. Paul later says it's okay. You are to abstain from food sacrificed to idols, from blood, from the meat of strangled animals, and from sexual immorality. You will do well to avoid these things. Farewell. That's what they said. They said, look, we don't want to make it difficult for people to become Christians, basically. So just adhere to these few things and you'll be fine. You don't have to obey all the 613 laws of the Old Testament or whatever it was. That's all passed away anyway. So the point here is that don't major in the minors. The main things are the plain things. The plain things are the main things. And when you're looking for the meaning in the text, don't throw dirt on the plain meaning by digging for a deeper meaning. People are always trying to look for deeper meanings. Sometimes it's just the plain meaning that's right there. Now, it can be sometimes hard to figure out what that is. In fact, especially when you're reading the epistles. Why? Well, like say you're reading 1 Corinthians. Sometimes Paul is talking about issues in the church at Corinth, and you're not quite sure what those issues are. You're kind of reading between the lines. In fact, one book puts it this way. They say reading some parts of the Bible is like listening to only one side of a telephone conversation. You ever listen to one side of a telephone conversation? You're not quite sure what the person On the other line is saying, you can hear the person in the room talking, but you can't hear what the other person's saying. And when you know, you kind of get the gist of what's going on, but after they hang up, you go, hey, what did they say, right? Well, sometimes interpreting some of the epistles is like that. You only got one side of the telephone conversation. So it can be difficult sometimes. We understand that. Now, let me ask you one other thing as we dive into the principles here of interpreting. What's the 80-20 rule? I'm sure you've heard of the 80-20 rule. 20% of what you do gives you 80% of your results. For example, what's the 80-20 rule in health? Well, eat right, get enough sleep, and exercise, right? If you eat right, get enough sleep, and exercise, chances are that 20% of the things you do will be responsible for 80% or more of your health. If you do those things, or if you don't do those things, your health is going to be affected, generally speaking. You know, special diets, vitamins, that's all extra. The real keys to good health are eat right, get enough sleep, exercise. How about in football? What do you have to do in football to be successful? The fundamentals, right? You block, you tackle, and we can't turn the ball over. You always hear coaches say that. You can't turn the ball over. I mean, just look at the last Super Bowl. I think both teams had one turnover. Matt Ryan, if he had thrown an incomplete pass on third down instead of taking a sack, he would have won the Super Bowl. Instead, it turned into a turnover. Well, it wasn't an official turnover. He didn't fumble at that point. He fumbled earlier, but he wound up having to punt. If he had kicked a field goal, if he had not taken a sack, he'd just thrown the ball away. And he kicked a field goal there, and it had been up by 11. Patriots couldn't have come back. But to their credit, the Patriots did. It's one of the fundamentals of the game. Don't turn the ball over. How about in real estate? What are the three fundamentals? You already know. Location, location, location. Right? Okay. What are the fundamentals of interpreting the Bible? You ready? Context, context, context. Let me say it again. Context, context, context. Just like interpreting that newspaper line I mentioned earlier at the top of the program, right? Somebody reads you a newspaper quote. You don't even know what section it's from the newspaper. Here's the quote. After a strike, your entire team will celebrate. You need context to know what that means. It could mean bowling. It could mean baseball, fishing, volleyball, oil or gold, union strike, a military strike. You don't know. You need context. Same thing is true with the Bible. You need context. So the question is, how do you get the context? How do you know the context? All right. Well, here's what you do. You want to stop to interpret the Bible. Stop. That's the acronym we're using here. S-T-O-P. What does it stand for? The S stands for the situation. What's the situation we're in here? When you're reading Jeremiah 29, what's the situation? Well, it turns out to be a letter. And it's written to people in Babylon 2,500 years ago. It's about the exiles in Babylon. That's the situation, right? The T stands for type. What do I mean by type? What's the type of literature we're talking about here? The Bible has several different types of literature. It's got history. It's got law. It's got poetry. It's got prophecy. It's got wisdom. It's got epistles, like letters, like Romans, like 1 Corinthians. It's got apocalyptic literature, like some of Daniel and Revelation. It's got hyperbole. That's a literary device. Exaggeration. I preach the gospel all over the world to every living thing. That's hyperbole. It's got, and some would even say it's hyperbole. God says, wipe everybody out in the Old Testament. The Paul Copan, his book, Is God a Moral Monster, makes that case. It's got metaphors, like I am the door. We already talked about that. It's got parables, like the prodigal son, which shouldn't be called the prodigal son. It should be called the parable of the gracious father. In fact, we'll talk about that in a future program. So you've got to know what type of literature and what type of literary device is being used in the text, because you're going to interpret those differently, right? You're going to interpret history differently than, say, a metaphor, or history different from, say, poetry, right? I mean, if I read If I read a poem about the Civil War, I may get some good historical information from that poem, but I'm not going to press every single line in that poem to its literal extent, or every single word. I know it's a poem. So you're going to interpret things differently based on the type of literature. The O stands for the object. Who is the object of the passage? Is the object me today, or is the object an Israelite exile in Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar 2,500 years ago? Who's the object? And the P in stop stands for prescription. Is this a prescription or a description? Is this just describing what happened 2,500 years ago, or is it a prescription for us today? Those are the things that you need to take into account when you're trying to interpret the Bible. Stop, situation, type, object, and prescription. Now, does this cover everything? No, but it's the 80-20 rule. I submit to you that these few things will help you with 80% or more of the passages you need to interpret. It'll guide you most of the time to the right answer, in other words. Now, where can you learn more about this? I unpack this in the book Stealing from God. Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. So if you want more on this, get the book Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. And when we come back, we're going to actually apply this to a passage in the Bible. The STOP acronym. Situation, type, object, prescription. All right? Because we want to interpret the Bible properly, because it's the most important skill you can learn in life so you can have a successful life. I'm Frank Turek. You're listening to Cross Examined on the American Family Radio Network website, crossexamined.org. Back in 2 minutes. Don't go away. Stop to interpret the Bible properly. Make sure you look at the situation, the type of literature, the object of the text, and discover whether it's a prescription or a description. Now, how do you go about doing this? Well, let me point out that people who do this for a living, preachers, they don't know all this stuff. They don't know it by heart. They go to seminary, they learn this stuff. But preachers like myself, what we do on our TV show, and preachers who preach every Sunday, they have tools, and you should have tools as well. There are many tools out there you can get that will help you do this. First of all, you ought to have a study Bible. And in fact, the NIV study Bible, the Nearly Inspired Version, I really like. I think the notes in there are quite good. You have an apologetic study Bible. There's all sorts of different study Bibles you can get out there. That will help you as you're reading through a passage. It'll help you get the situation, the type of literature, the object, and whether it's prescriptive or descriptive, the STOP acronym. So get a study Bible. Also get conservative commentaries out there. There are many good conservative commentaries. When I say conservative, I mean these are people that actually believe the Bible's true, okay? And they believe that the proper way to interpret the text is the historical grammatical text, the methods that we're using here, that there are different types of literature in there, and you need to interpret the Bible in a common sense way based on the type of literature. You know, what's the situation, what's the type of literature, whether who's the object here, whether it's prescriptive or descriptive. There's a good Bible, kind of a catch-all Bible commentary that doesn't go into too much detail, but enough. It's from the Dallas Theological Seminary group, it was written about 30 years ago. In fact, Dr. Norman Geiser, my co-author on a couple of books, was one of the contributors to it. It's called the Bible Knowledge Commentary. He was on the Dallas Theological Seminary faculty. It's two volumes. It's in-depth enough, but not too in-depth, and it can give you the overall view that you'll need. Again, it's probably one of these 20% of the books you can get that'll help you get 80% of what you need to know or more. Also, the Big Book of Bible Difficulties I mentioned earlier, that will help you as well. You need to get that book by Norman Geiser and Tom Howe. And if you really want to go into this in detail, get Logos Bible Software. You can get all these books on Logos Bible software, and you can do amazing things on Logos Bible software. Now, this is not cheap. It could cost you several thousand dollars if you want to get the whole library. But you can get a decent version of it for a few hundred bucks. Logos, L-O-G-O-S, Bible software. Check them out. And a good book on how to interpret the Bible, which I've used, is a book I actually read in seminary and has been updated since then. It's called How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth. How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth by Gordon Fee and Douglas Stewart. Gordon Fee, F-E-E-E, and Douglas Stewart, S-T-U-A-R-T. Check it out. How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth. Not a difficult book, but good enough to be even used in seminary and to be used just by lay people out there. All right. Now, I'm going to apply the STOP acronym in just a minute. Let me mention some other people you can listen to. These are some preachers and apologists I listen to. Now, I don't agree with everything every one of these people say. I don't even agree with everything I say, okay? So if I say somebody and you go, oh, that guy, I don't agree with that. Okay, fine, okay? Again, don't major in the minors. Every one of the people I'm about to mention here are conservative Christians who actually believe the Bible's inerrant, and I think many of their teachings are brilliant. Now, again, I may not agree with every minor point they make, but they're great people to listen to, okay? I'm just going to list them right now. Tim Keller up at Redeemer Church in New York. Fabulous insights. Andy Stanley. If you want somebody who can reach out to unbelievers quite well, Tim Keller does it well as well, but so does Andy Stanley. So check him out. Norman Geisler, my co-author. Ravi Zacharias, of course. Whatever Ravi writes, God reads. You know that. By the way, just this past week, Ravi had, I don't know how many people at Michigan. I think 3,500 at University of Michigan, probably 10,000 at Michigan State. They had a bigger venue there. Ravi's great. John Lennox over there in the UK. Fabulous. William Lane Craig, of course. J. Warner Wallace, my friend, cold case homicide detective. Greg Kokel, new book, The Story of Reality. Had him on a few weeks ago. You need to get that book. Great stuff. R.C. Sproul. Now, I'm not a five-point Calvinist, but I love R.C. Sproul. Okay? He has some great insights as well. Tony Evans, down there in Oak Cliff Bible Fellowship, down there in Dallas. He's great. Alistair Begg. You ever listen to Alistair Begg? B-E-G-G. He's got some great stuff as well. I mean, I can go on. Those are just some of the people I tend to listen to, and I think that can help you interpret the Bible properly. Now, let's take this STOP acronym. We've done it before to Jeremiah 29:11, so I'm going to do it with a different passage. Let's do it with the passage. You always hear this passage quoted. Where two or three come together in my name, there I am with them. All right, let's stop. What's the situation? Okay. That's the S. Well, where does this come from? It comes from Matthew chapter 18. Now, for you, those of you Christians in here, when you hear the Matthew 18, what do you automatically think of? Well, I automatically think of, well, Matthew 18, that's the passage in there where you're going to a church discipline situation. You know, you've got some brother in there who's done something wrong or offended you, and you have to go through a process to reconcile with the brother. Or if they are wrong, then there's going to be consequences with the church. And that's exactly what this passage is about. I mean, many people will say, where two or three have come together in my name, there I am with them. Oh, that means we got to get two or three people together and pray, and then God is there. Is that really what that means? Look at Matthew 18. I'm just going to read the passage. Let's get the situation. Oh, by the way, the T, type. What's type? It's in a gospel, okay? It doesn't appear to be a parable, as we see here. So it's just Jesus speaking and giving us some instruction. And what does he say? Here's what he says, Matthew 18, 15 to 20. If your brother sins against you, go and show him his fault, just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you have won your brother over. But if he will not listen, take one or two others along so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Ooh, that's from the Old Testament. If you want to establish somebody's guilty of something, you need two or three witnesses. And that's what he's quoting here. He goes on to say, if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen to the church, treat him as you would a pagan or a tax collector. He goes on, Jesus says, I tell you the truth. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, I tell you that if two of you on earth agree about anything you ask for, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three come together in my name, there I am with them. Okay. We got the situation. It's church discipline. The type of literature, it's a gospel, it's an historical account. Jesus has just given us some instruction. The object, the O in stop, appears to be Christians in general, right? And the P stands for, is this prescriptive or descriptive? This is a straight prescription. This is what you ought to do if somebody has, if you have a problem with somebody in the church or some other believer. This is what you do. But what does the end of this mean? For where two or three come together in my name, there is this talking about people getting together and praying? And then the Lord is with them? No. What's the context? The context is you need two or three witnesses in order to convict somebody of something. And if you do that and you do it honorably and honestly, then the Lord is with that particular decision that you make. What you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. This has nothing to do with people coming together in prayer and having God with them. God is with you whether you're praying alone or praying with 1,000 people. I mean, I always thought people who interpret it the common way, I go, well, what do you think is happening when you're alone? That God isn't there? You need two or three other people? Jesus said, go pray alone. Go in your closet and pray. So he couldn't mean that this passage here requires two or three people so God is with you when you pray. No, it means that you need two or three witnesses. And if you honestly come to the right conclusion here, God will honor that. So you go through the STOP acronym, the situation, the type, the object, and the prescription to figure out what the passage means, to discover what it means, not what it means to you, but what it really means, what Jesus meant by it, what the writer meant by it. Now, if you don't do this, friends, you can destroy your life because you can take passages in the Bible out of context and cause you to doubt that the God even exists. You take Jeremiah 29:11 out of context. You think it's promising you prosperity. And then you, for some reason, you're not prosperous. You either A, doubt God, doubt the Bible, or think God doesn't even exist when it doesn't come true for you. It was never meant for you. And so you need to interpret the Bible properly. You take, and the name it, claim it preachers do this all the time. They take a passage out of context, and they say, you just have enough faith, you're going to be prosperous financially. Oh, it didn't come true for you? I guess you don't have enough faith. Or, gee, you pray in my name, it's going to be done for you no matter what. That's not what the text says. You need to know the context. Oh, it's not done for me. God doesn't exist or he's evil, right? That's what we think. You see, it's how you interpret these passages. That's the problem. If you interpret them improperly, you're going to have bad theology and maybe a bad eternity then. If you interpret them properly, then you'll have good theology and hopefully a good eternity. Now, look, I'm not saying you have to be a Bible scholar to get to heaven. Don't get me wrong. Getting to heaven is not like getting into Harvard. But you need to know the essentials. And the main things are the plain things, and the plain things are the main things. However, you can take some of these passages out of context and really create havoc in your own life and the life of others. Here's a light moment from the Babylon Bee. Mountain climber recovering after decision to let go and let God. That's not in the Bible, that passage, but if you misinterpreted it as a mountain climber, you'd be in trouble. All right, friends, there's more on this in the book, Stealing from God, Why Atheists Need God to Make Their Case. Don't forget, I'm going to be in a number of places coming up, Arizona, Chicago, University of Ohio, Canada. Check all that out on our website. See you next time. I'm Frank Turek. God bless.